Honorable Chairperson, my name is Sven Rotova. I'm leading the delegation as the acting DG, and I'll ask from the left the acting commissioner, Unemployment Insurance Fund, to also introduce herself.
Good morning. My name is Fazeka Pose. I'm the acting UIF commissioner.
My name is Vuyo Mafata from the URF.
My name is Lerato Molevazi. I am the Deputy Director General responsible for corporate services.
Good morning. My name is Toby Lelamati. I'm the Acting Deputy Director General of Inspection and Enforcement Services.
My name is Beima Dona, Chief Financial Officer of the Department of Labor.
I'm Jodu Mutani, Chief Operations Officer of the Department of Labor.
Good morning, I'm Monito from PNG.
Morning, I'm Jixin from the Department of Labor.
Good morning, I'm Titus.
No. Wait, Titus. Come closer to the mic, please. You are welcome here.
Good morning, my name is Titus Nsweni from the Department of Labor, Acting Director, Employment Standards.
Morning, I'm Mukhadi, Communications Department of Labor.
Morning, I'm Johannes Mugo, Communications Department of Labor.
Good morning, my name is Lalista Aderbigbe from UIF. I'm the Director responsible for Budget and Expenditure.
Producer, my name is Lizanne Bridenang. I'm the Acting CFO UIF.
I hope everybody introduce himself and or herself. But without wasting any time, I'll request the following things. Number one, those who have their gadget like this one, may we please switch them off or keep them in silence, because the digital instruments which I've got, sometimes they are disturbing, because when you put them closer to this system, they've got a negative impact sometimes, most of the time, in fact. And then, without wasting any time, for the agenda of today is, number one, is a consideration of the report of financial statement of the Unemployment Insurance Fund, which is UIF for 2010-2011, including the report of the independent auditors and the financial statement of and the performance information for 2010-2011. In brackets, which is quoted like RP 281/2011. Then the second one, it will be the report on financial statement of the Department of Labor for 2017 for 2010-2011, including the report of the Auditor General on the financial statement and performance information for 2010-2011. And the report of the Auditor General on the statement and performance information of the sheltered employment factories for 2010-2011, open quotes, RP 117/2011. I'll give it to you maybe to start, give the presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll be taking you through the UIF presentation, that is the annual report for the 2010-11. In terms of what we've covered, we'll be looking at the legislative mandate of the UIF, the vision and mission, the funding model, the institutional spread, corporate governance, and then the performance information for 2010-11, the unemployment alleviation schemes that the UIF has embarked on. And then if we move then to slide number 3, in terms of the legislative mandate of the UIF is has two legislations that UIF is mandated. number 63 and the Unemployment Contributions Act. The first act, that is the Unemployment Insurance Act, was established and it gives the powers to the UIF to register all employers and employees in the in South Africa. And then in terms of the Contributions Act, the Unemployment Contributions Act empowers the SARS Commissioner to collect monthly contributions from employers and workers on behalf of the UIF. In terms of our vision, the Unemployment Insurance Fund tries to contribute to the alleviation of poverty in South Africa by providing effective short-term unemployment insurance to all workers who qualify for the unemployment and related benefits. In terms of our mission, the Unemployment Insurance Fund sees itself as rendering an effective and accessible service to all stakeholders, being a sustainable organization with sufficient reserves, and administering the fund professionally. In terms of the funding model, the UIF receives its funding from contributions from employers and employees, that is 2% of the payroll levy. These levies are paid on a monthly basis to the UIF as part of their source of income. In terms of our geographic spread, we are available in the 9 provinces. We've got 125 labor centers where the public can access the UIF. We also have 820 visiting sites where we receive the UIF applications and then take them to the processing centers, of which now we have 81 processing centers where we receive, we process those claims in those processing centers. The next slide, it shows, it's a demonstration of our labor centers and our accessibility in terms of the provinces and the labor centers. And then the next slide, which talks to the overview of the UIF, we're saying there, in the 2010-11, the fund received a clean audit from the Office of the Auditor General. This is the sixth and unqualified report for the UIF since 2005 and 2006, which means that the UIF is operating at a clean slate. The next slide. The next slide looks at the operational performance of the UIF. The fund has about 1.5 million employers who are currently registered with the UIF. That is your commercial, your domestic, and the taxi industry. And we've seen an increase there from 1.2 million to 1.3 in the year 2010-11. And then in terms of the taxi sector, there is a slow registration of employers there. If you can look at the graph there, there's a slight increase in terms of the numbers. In 2010, we had about let me start with the commercial employers. We had 689,000 employers registered with the UIF in 2010. We've seen a growth of about 6.9% of employers registering to 737,000 employers. With the domestics, there's a slight increase as well of 2%. From 591,000 to 606 employers registered with the Unemployment Insurance Fund. With the taxi industry as well, we've seen an increase of about 4.6% from 6,000 to 6,400 in 2010-11. So in total, our total registered employers are sitting at 1.3 million. And then in terms of the employees registered, by their reported employers in terms of the commercial sector. We've got about 7.2 million employees registered with the unemployment insurance fund, which is a 2% increase as compared to the previous financial year. With the domestics, there's a very slight increase in terms of the employees registered of about 0.6%. And then with the taxi industry, you'd also see that there's about 2% of the employees registered with unemployment. That is the increase. If you compare the employers and the employees, like in terms of the taxi industry, you would realize that there's more employers than the employees that are registered. This is due to the non-declaration of employers in terms of declaring their employees that are registered with them. But we are following up in ensuring that all the employers declare their employees with the UIF. Next slide. In terms of our benefits, the UIF pays for the unemployment insurance benefits. It also pays for the illness, maternity benefits, and adoption and dependence benefits. If we look at the monetary value that has been paid in terms of these benefits, you will see that in 2009 we had paid 2.8 billion in terms of unemployment insurance. And then in 2010, there was a huge increase in terms of the benefits that we paid. This was due to the economic recession. And then there's a slight decrease again in 2011 to 4.1 billion. In terms of our illness benefits, we've paid, you'd also see that there's an increase in terms of the money that has been paid from 211 million to 231 million in 2010 and 232 million in 2011. In terms of our maternity benefits and adoption, there's also an increase from 537 million in 2009 financial year. In 2010, it was 624 million. And then in 2011, there's a huge increase there as well of 659 million. Dependent benefits, you also see an increase there from 263 million in 2009. And then in 2010, we've paid 317 million. And then again, there's a slight increase in terms of those dependence benefits in 2011 to 317.5 million in 2011. So in total, you would see that our benefits are increasing from 3.8 billion in 2009 to 5.3 billion in 2011. And then when the next slide, it just compares the increase in terms of percentages in terms of our benefits, as I've explained above, to say that our employment insurance benefits have gone down in the 2010-11 as compared to the 2009-10 because of the economic recession. In 2010-11, we saw an improvement in terms of the economy. And then our illness benefits as well have gone down. Maternity benefits as well have gone down. And the number of our dependents as well. This slide, it only shows the numbers of our beneficiaries. That we've seen a decrease in terms of the numbers. And then in terms of the provincial spread, how we are paying our benefits, you would see that in the Eastern Cape, we've received 63.3 thousand claims, and we've approved 63.2 thousand claims with a rejection rate of about 1%. Free State. 37,400 claims were received, and 36.9 was approved, which then resulted in 1.3% rejection. Gauteng, which is our biggest in terms of claims, we've received 211,400 claims, and we've processed or approved 207. The rejection rate there as well is 1.7. If you go down, you will also see that on average, in terms of our processing of claims, there's only about, on average, the 2.6 rejection. So in total, what the claims that we've received in the year 2010-11 was 751,000 claims, and 732 claims were processed, and only 19,000 were rejected. And there are several reasons for rejecting those claims. And then in terms of the numbers per province, our biggest province being Gauteng, we've paid 1.8 billion in terms of the benefits. That is all the benefits that we pay. And then the numbers of claimants, it's about 207, as has been reported above. Right down, if you go, you'd see that in KZN, we've processed 951 million. And then the beneficiaries there, we have 138,000 beneficiaries. As you, our biggest provinces here in terms of the claims is your Gauteng, KZN, Western Cape, and Eastern Cape. In total, we've paid 5.3 billion to 732,000 beneficiaries. In terms of our human resources management, we have a staff establishment of about 555 posts, of which 425, that is 93%, has been filled, and 30%, and 30, which is equivalent to 5.6%, is vacant. Of the 93% posts filled, 56 are female, and 43.5% are male. 2% of that establishment is people with disabilities. As at the end of 2010-11, 33% of the employees were sitting at the senior SMS level are women. And then if we look at the salary bands or the salary levels, salary level, your level 3 to level 6, the staff establishment, we've got about 270 posts, 259 have been filled, and 11 are vacant, which is tantamount to 4.0% vacancy rate. And at SR level 7 to 8, we've got 100 in terms of the establishment, and 89 has been filled. In terms of your middle management, which is level 9 to level 12, we've got 73 posts, of which 68 has been filled. 5 are vacant, which is equal to 6% in terms of the vacancy rate. In terms of the professionals, your SMS, we've got 12 posts, of which 9 are filled and 3 are vacant, which is equals to 25%. In total, our vacancy rate is sitting at 6.5% at the end of March 2011. In terms of our appointments and promotions and terminations, you'd also see there that in this financial year we had appointed 20 employees, and promotions, that is within the organization or within the UIF, we've promoted about 27 employees, and we have 11 terminations. Of the 11 terminations, 6 were due to resignations because of people seeing greener pastures. 2, we had 2 deaths. and one retirement and two misconducts. And then in terms of our misconduct and discipline, we had six written warnings, four final written warnings, and two dismissals, and two resignations due to misconduct. The next slide, it talks to our skills development. In terms of our human resources, the fund pays its human capital and strives to continuously develop its staff. In this financial year, we had recruited 104 interns, 19 at the head office, and 85 were deployed to the provinces. And then in terms of the training, 340 officials were trained on more than 30 accredited training initiatives. 24 officials were awarded bursaries, that is your bursaries for 3 year studies. In terms of the financial performance of the fund, you'd see that the fund has done very well in terms of receiving its contribution. The fund has collected 5.3% more than what it had collected in 2009. 10.75 billion was collected in 2009-10, and in 2010-11, 11.3 billion was collected. In terms of its investment revenue, we had realized 2.9% of revenue in terms of how we have invested our funding. And then in terms of our benefits, we have paid 5.3 billion as compared to the 5.7 billion that was paid in 2009-10. And then in terms of our net surplus, the net surplus had increased by 38% from 6.8 billion in 2009-10 to 9.46 billion in 2010-11. This is due to the decrease in the benefits payments, and as well as the increase in the contributions that were collected. The total investment portfolio also increased by 20.6% from 43.7 billion to 52.6 billion in 2010-11. In terms of our summary, you'd see that the fund has contributions of about 11.3%, which is an increase from 2009-10 of 10.7 billion. The investment income, as has been reported today, it had increased by 2% from 3.4 billion to 5.5 billion. Benefits payments or expenditure, it had decreased from 5.7 billion to 5.3. And then our investments had increased from 43.7 billion to 52.6 billion. Our technical reserves, this is money that we set aside for future benefits, which had also increased from 12.4 billion to 13.2 billion. Our accumulated reserves or surplus, had also increased from 28.6 billion to 37.3 billion. Our total assets, you see they've increased from 44.9 billion to 54 billion. The next graph, it shows the steady increase in terms of our contributions. If you look at 2008, we're sitting at 9.4, we're collecting 9 billion, and in 2011, we managed to collect 11.3 billion. same as our investment revenue, you'd see a steady increase from 2 billion to 3.5 billion in 2011. In terms of our spending, we had spent 6.4 billion. The major part of our spending, you'd see that it's due to the benefits that we pay to our beneficiaries. In terms of our admin costs, we only utilize 5%. Our operating costs, only 3%. And the unemployment alleviation schemes, it's only 1%. And our staff costs, only 8%. So the major part of our spending is on our benefits. In terms of how we've invested our assets, that is our funding, 61% of our investment are invested in the bonds. Only 15% is with the equity, that is your shares. And then we've got only 18% on fixed deposits, and the other 6% on your money markets. In terms of our performance information, if we look at the first indicator there, we said we needed to enroll at least 800 persons on the poverty alleviation scheme. In terms of our performance, we managed to enroll 1,976 selected from the UIF database to the training layoff scheme using the MQA. And then in terms of the next indicator there, we had set ourselves to implement a quarterly monitoring of management actions. All strategic risks identified were monitored as per the set time frame, and implementation of management action was monitored. In terms of fraud and fraud prevention and detection, we had set ourselves to finalize 82 cases, but in terms of our achievement, we managed to finalize 97% of our cases within the search times. In terms of our risk monitoring and risk appetite, we had set ourselves to develop a risk management framework, of which we have done, and all strategic risks were monitored in line with our risk appetite. Second slide. We had set ourselves to increase 20% of the usage of the U-filing system, where the employers declare their employees or their employees on electronically. In terms of the usage, 73% was achieved in terms of the U-filing system or utilization. And then in terms of the next indicator there, we wanted to increase the processing centers to a total of 76 processing centers. In terms of our achievement, we have 81, not 84, there's a typo there, 81 processing centers that are receiving and processing claims in the provinces. And then in terms of the increases in terms of the CPI as compared to the previous financial year, 5.3% increase to 4.1% that was set in the previous financial year. In terms of collecting the outstanding debt, that is, we had set ourselves to collect 15% of the outstanding balance on overpayments. In terms of the performance, we had achieved 22%. 22% of our debt was collected in this financial year. In terms of communication and outreach, we had set ourselves to reach about 15 million audience according to the GCIS survey. And in terms of the performance, or rather our performance, we had managed to reach 41 million viewers. in terms of the Telma report. One of our indicators was to also submit the head office structure by end of July 2010 and the implementation by March 2011. The structure was prepared and is in the process of approval by the in the processes. It's currently with the DPSA to approve the new structure to support the UIF. In terms of the audits, all the audits that were planned by the internal audit were conducted in that financial year. I'll just go to the last indicator there to say we wanted to finalize 80% of our claims or process of 80% of our claims within 5 weeks. There we had fall short. 73% of the claims were finalized within 5 weeks. And then in terms of unemployment alleviating schemes that we had embarked on, the reintegration into the labor market, there was a pilot project to reintegrate the unemployed into the labor market. We have produced 132 artisans. The Minister of Labour has started a project that will see 3,500 unemployed beneficiaries enter the artisan development program that is in a long term. But for this financial year, we only managed to produce 132 artisans. In terms of the training layoff scheme, the UIF had set aside 1.2 billion to assist with the training layoffs to assist companies in distress due to economic downturn to companies who are at a risk of being retrenched or employees who are at a risk of being retrenched. In terms of the funding agreements that were signed, 21.9 million was entered into with the companies that had applied for financial assistance for training for these employees, and only 6.3 million was utilized. At the end of March, the scheme had saved 3,000 jobs in the clothing and textile and the car manufacturing sector. Chairperson, if I may elaborate, the scheme, the 1.2 billion was not only set for one financial year, but it's going to be spread throughout the period for as long as there is a need for this scheme. And then we've got another social responsibility investment that we have done with IDSIM, that is your Industrial Development Corporation. We had set aside 2 billion in bonds. By end of March, 1 billion had been successfully been drawn by IDC to support unemployment activities or initiatives, and a total of 76 transactions to a value of 1.5 billion had been approved. The approved transactions were expected to create business plans, of which 10,047 new permanent unemployed paying jobs were created, and 7,000 existing permanent jobs. And in terms of the approved transactions, the approved transactions resulted in a combined total of 17,200 jobs being saved and some created. At an average cost per job of 222,000. And in terms of the geographical spread, it has been spread throughout all the provinces. The current challenges that are being faced by the UIF is the current economic conditions that are affecting the job creation and contributing to the job losses in the country. that is the decline in your revenue growth, as well as the increased pressure on the operations, because the more people are unemployed, the more UIF is demanded, or the more the demand on UIF. And then I'll conclude the chairperson. Thank you.
Right, but I'd rather commented to comment with something, as I've announced earlier on. I was advised that the second presentation will be as follows: a report on financial statement by the Department of Labor, vote 17 for 2011 and 2011, including the report of the Auditor General on financial statement and performance information on 2010-2011 only. So, members, I wanted to get an advice. Must I allow the second presentation so that you note your questions? Is it okay? Are you comfortable?
Mm-hmm.
I'll request the second presentation to continue, please.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Let me start off by extending the apology of the Director General. I'm sure you have had a number of acting people, and that is because of the unavailability of the colleagues, either due to leave, sicknesses, and hence the appointment by the Minister in the respective positions. I'll be presenting the report that was tabled already in Parliament. I'm sure honourable members have the green copies. This is the report of the 1st of April 2010 to the 31st March 2011. And as we speak, we are in the process of finalising the annual report of the Department of Labour. 1st of April 2011 to March 2012. So the information, in a way, is already almost a year old. The first slide talks to the mandate of the department. That is, the contents of the presentation talks to the mandate. The MTEF, the key key aspects of the strategic plan of the 2010-11, and the budget allocation and utilization, and Ms. Vedma Duna, the Chief Financial Officer, will do that presentation. I won't waste your time through the vision. It has not changed. The mission of the department also has not changed. And just a reminder that the Department of Labor, in terms of its contribution to the overall government strategic objective, will contribute to the outcome number 4, which is decent employment, outcome number 11, which is creating a better South Africa, and contribute to a better and safer Africa and the world, and outcome number 12, which is an efficient, effective, and development-oriented public service, and an empowered and inclusive citizenship. So all our work is aligned to the three main objectives of government, as all departments have to show how their work and their budget is spent on the 12 outcomes that we have at the moment. Now, the next slide just shows you how we have broken down environmental objectives in the strat plan and align them to the four, that is the three main objectives, that is outcome 4, outcome number 11, and outcome number 12, and how on the other side the strategic objectives of the department align with that process. Now, slide 6 gives you a brief overview of the programs of the department. Now, honorable members, you'll notice that the entities that are aligned to the department are not shown there, but most of those entities would normally be linked to Program 3, for instance, the Productivity South Africa, Sheltered Employment Factories, the Unemployment Insurance Fund, and the Compensation Fund will be linked to Program 3, or else Program 4, in terms of their budget allocation, they also make transfers to other entities such as NEDLAC, CCMA, that are also not shown in there. But the budget allocation, as Mr. Maduna presents, will show you figures that are transferred to those entities. Now, briefly, in terms of the annual report of administration, which is listed on pages 19 to 33 of the annual report, and briefly what administration consists of in the department, is that it is inclusive of the office of the DG, the financial management, operations, and corporate services with all its directorates as listed. Now, I won't go into, you know, what I'm going to do is to reflect only on slide 9 on the achievements, and I'm going to do the same on, that is, in terms of OSLA, because the key performance indicators and the target are what is in strategic plan and is something that we're frozen, that has not changed. And I'm just going to report on the achievements. As of the 31st of March 2011, the department achieved an unqualified report, and we have had, in terms of performance indicator 2, 91.4% of posts were filled against a target of 90%, and the vacancy rate stood at 8.5%. Women employed at senior management level was at 34.6% against a target of 40%. Youth were at 42.8%, and the national target for people with disabilities in the public service is currently at 2%, but we managed in the department to achieve a 2.7% target. We have set ourselves as the Department of Labor a 5% target, which is above the norm that is set in the public service. On slide 10, against indicator number 4, the department was rated the third best amongst large departments in resolving calls lodged in the presidential's hotline. And as of March 2011, we received 4,742 calls, and we managed to resolve 4,677, which is 98% of the total calls received. And in terms of indicator 5, the spatial mapping of labor centers to ensure accessibility to clients in line with outcome 4 is in progress. Currently, we have 125 labor centers across the country, and we participate in about 83 Tucson centers, and we also have mobile centers. So in terms of accessibility, the department has done its best within the constraint. in terms of the some of the challenges that we continue to have, the other two, I mean, the first one is in the process of being resolved on the capacity of the Chief Operations Office. The automation, that is the automation system to mainly track down and to ensure our monitoring and evaluation and the capacity in terms of our ICT is still a challenge because we continue to rely on a public-private partner that we have. I'll go to program two, which is inspection enforcement. The report is on page 34 to 48 of the annual report. And again, I'll skip the slide on program purpose and the measurable objectives because those have remained standard as in the strat plan. They continue on the next page. And I'll go straight to, I mean, those are still the reports. I'll go straight to the next slide on achievements. Now, the key performance indicator, this is a repeat of all those targets that I've skipped. Now, against key performance indicator two, employment equity implementation and enforcement mechanisms strengthened. Within the inspection and enforcement sector, 266 companies were reviewed as follows, and we'll give in the next slide a breakdown of those. 96 were Johannesburg Stock Exchange listed companies were reviewed, and 87 recommendations were served. 170 designated companies were reviewed, and 156 recommendations were served. A total of 9,468 Employment Equity Act procedural inspections were conducted, and of those, 7,449 compliance rate was achieved. The next slide in 18 just gives honorable members a breakdown of those slides in terms of the province, that is per province, and at the bottom it gives you the totals, like I've said in the previous slide. If I can move on to the next slide, 19. Against a strategic objective five, 200,000 workplace inspected for compliance, we managed as of 31st March 2011 to have 192,129 workplace inspected. 378 of these were conducted in high-risk sectors to enforce compliance with occupational health and safety, and 147,626, that is 77 compliance was achieved. The 147 is against the 192 workplace inspected. On slide 20, you have again a total breakdown of those inspections per province, a breakdown of the compliance rate, the breakdown of notices issued, the prosecution in terms of cases that are currently underway, and the various magistrate, that is magisterial districts. And the last column gives you an indication of the awards that have been issued to date. On slide 21, against indicator 6, that is target SMM is to ensure 80% compliance through advocacy campaigns, we managed to achieve within the INN steel, that is sector, to conduct seminars in PE and a total of 176 people participated. There was also a seminar within the forestry sector to basically advocate health and safety aspects and to make sure that they understand what we do. And the same seminars were conducted within the construction sector, mainly in Gauteng, and a total of 365 people attended. And a total of 1,021 shop stewards were also trained in employment equity, in occupational health and safety, and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. And against indicator 7, 80% of the investigated complaints are settled. A total of 120,566 complaints from a total of 154,441 complaints were investigated, and of those, 116,131 were settled within 90 days. The next slide just gives you a breakdown again per province of all those complaints received, those that were investigated per province, those that were settled within the 90 days per province, the settlement rate. And the last column just gives you an indication of the money recovered. Now, this money recovered will in the main be monies that were owed to workers, where people will come to the Department of Labor offices to complain that I was dismissed and I was not paid my salaries. So this money, once collected, does not come to the Department of Labor. It goes directly to the complainant. And the slide indicates that a total of 15.8 million was collected as outstanding wages or salaries from employers against the complaints lodged and given back to the respectful owners. On the next slide, 8, that is strategic objective 8, promote the level of knowledge of OHS. We have had the concept of roving safety representative inspectors that was launched in Limpopo and Mpumalanga, and this is something that we have been working with and experimenting this concept and with the Belgians to try and make sure that we can have this concept implemented across a number of countries, on that is on provinces. On the reduction and on the prevalence of silicosis in the non-mining industry, up to end of March last year, we've had a baseline study conducted, and we also looked at the extent of exposure to silica dust in 200 companies, especially in Gauteng. And we have also had 49 companies assisted during the inspection to develop a program to control exposure. And 208 companies were inspected with regard to silica exposure, and 54 companies complied, which resulted in a 26% compliance level. Against, and that is an indicator of 200,000 workplace inspected, we managed to make sure as of 31st March 2011 to target, that is, we've had targets reviewed in accordance with available resource, because the target seems to be too high, and based on the resources and capacity although we had this target in our threat plan, we had to review that. And one of the things that was done was to conduct an organizational development study to try and determine the number of appropriate inspectors, including the kind of competencies we need for them to be able to reach the 200,000 workplaces inspected. And the other thing that was done was to review the job profiles in line with the professionalization process that we are currently involved in. And in line with the, that is the reduction of noise, we also had to look at the whole question of the bids adjudication process. But in the main, you'll notice that some of the actions taken were in the main trying to capacitate the organization or the inspection and enforcement in order to be able to achieve those performance indicators listed in the first column. And this process, by and large, we've done a lot of work during the 2011-12 financial year. I'll go straight to public employment services, and the report is covered in page 49-59 of the annual report. Again, Honorable Chairperson and members, I'll skip the program purpose. It is pretty standard. And I'll also skip the measurable objectives because they are pretty standard. They are repeated again in the indicator. I will also skip the next slide because this is part of measurable objectives that are repeated in each indicator. Again, those service delivery indicators and objectives are again repeated in the tables that I'm going to present. I'll skip them and go straight to the table on achievements. Now, again, objective, strategic objective one, that is contribution to employment creation, and key performance indicator number one, relating to the approval of legislation. The indicator talks about cabinet in September 2010. Now, although that was achieved, we have moved to another phase, and unfortunately at the time, the bill, even though it was at, you know, approved by cabinet, was referred to NEDLAC for further consideration. Against performance indicator two on the number of job seekers registered, we managed to register a total of 652,000 in different categories, and these were mainly in terms of forms that they filled manually. And the process of translating that information from manual to the system was also undertaken, and at the end of the financial year, out of a total of 652,000 applicants that reported in our department, 483,000 forms were captured and registered on the ESSA system. And that was partly because of the capacity that we had to be able to capture those forms. And in the slide 30, we provide a breakdown of, firstly, the job seekers that reported in our different offices, those that were registered, and the percentage. And the next column gives you a breakdown of the job opportunities or placement opportunities that were reported per province, and the last column indicates the placement against that indicator, 65,000 job seekers were provided with career counseling, 25,800 were referred for work placement opportunities, and 451,000 were referred to UIF to collect benefits. 8,732 were mainly referred to the compensation fund for claims, and 7,200 were referred for skills development opportunities in the Department of Higher Education sector. And in the next slide, you have a breakdown of the numbers in terms of counseling, those that were placed per province, a breakdown of those referred to UIF per province compensation fund, and skills development opportunities. Against strategic objective 4, number of companies and work seekers in distress company, and again, because of the link of this project with the previous presentation done by Ms. Puzi, is that we work together in this one. There are some elements that the CCMA does, some elements that the Public Employment Services does, and there are some elements that higher education and CTAS and UIF does. Hence the repeat in the different areas without necessarily duplicating. Now, 19 companies were assisted to the value of 40.2 million paid by UIF, and UIF allocated that 48.5, and we managed to also, against the 48.5 million allocated to Productivity South Africa. This is for social plan, where companies are likely to close down to assist them with turnaround strategies. And there, 15,000 jobs were saved, and the CCMA also, through their intervention processes, managed to also save 9,200 jobs. And again, the unemployment insurance fund and the compensation fund, in terms of their revenue or their investment, invested in the region of 35 and 27 billion respectively with the Public Investment Corporation. Now, you'll notice, Honorable Chairperson and members, that we were not able to give you exactly the number of jobs created out of this investment, but we have since committed ourselves and had extensive discussions with the PIC, the Public Investment Corporation, so that they are able to tell us exactly the number of jobs that were created as a result of borrowing this money to your telecom, to Sandral, to all these agencies that are involved in AXA airport expansion and so on. Because in the main, monies from UIF and compensation fund are not stored in the bank; they are in turn invested with the PIC for further investment in this massive employment creation project. So when this IDC and so on claim that they have created jobs, what honorable members must also be aware of is that the UIF and CF play a major role in this process. The UIF also invests a lot in IDC, and those again are the total numbers, that is amount 1.5 billion that was spent, and a total of 10,000 permanent jobs that were created, and saving of at least 7,186 existing jobs. And the next slide just provides you a breakdown of the training layoff schemes applications per province. And I must hasten to say that the zero in province does not necessarily mean that there was no allocation. But what it may mean is that the companies in the respective province either did not have information on the scheme and therefore did not approach the CCMA and the committee that is responsible for the training layoff scheme to apply in order to save jobs in those areas. We have since taken this matter up, especially with the Free State, the Limpopo, and the Northern Cape, given the non-application by companies in the sector, and there has been initiatives to market the scheme and to also change the rules, because initially the scheme was basically assisting companies that were affected by global recession, and we have since expanded the scope to include disasters, droughts, and floods, and end of massive projects such as the HAO, that is the project that were linked to the 2010 World Cup, because those workers are finding themselves unemployed at the moment. On the numbers of companies assisted through Workplace Challenge, Productivity SA managed to assist 230 companies, and 105 future forums were also established to facilitate turnaround strategies. And a total of 2,700 SMME managers were trained in intellectual property management, just to make sure that they are able to protect their designs and so on. The challenges are the slow process in terms of the negotiations at MEDLEC, and in the main, it has to do with the IT system, because at the end of the previous financial year, the registration system was very slow, but there has been a lot of improvement during the year that ended 31st March 2012. On the Productivity SA side, the issue there, the main challenge was on the pace of the release of fund. This program used to be funded by the National Skills Fund, which has since moved to education, and the switch to get the Unemployment Insurance Fund Board to agree to the process took much more longer than we thought. And on the sheltered employment case, that is on performance indicator 4, special employment opportunities provided to eligible people with disabilities. The main issue there has been the development of the business case and trying to finalize the legal status, which is also included in the Employment Services Bill, and the review of the marketing strategy of the sheltered employment factories in order to make sure that we can increase revenue as the current transfer is insufficient. On program 4, which is on page 60 to 67 of the annual report, I'll skip the program purpose, I'll skip the measurable objectives because they are repeated. The next slide is also measurable objectives that are repeated. Now, slide 42, against key performance indicator 1, the bill was approved by Cabinet, that is the employment equity, and it was referred to NEDLEC. Against indicator 2, on employment equity implementation and enforcement mechanism strengthened. In the main, some of the aspects are contained in the bill, but 61 copies of DG final approval letters of affirmative action. action measures to address income differentials were served to various companies that were not seen to be complying, and the gap analysis was conducted, and the department has also embarked on a project with the assistance of the ILO to look at the possibility of implementing recommendations in 200 companies on HIV and AIDS. Against on slide 43 on Basic Conditions of Employment Act, again the amendments have been tabled to cabinet, and the bill at that stage was with neglect. On wage differential investigation, we managed to produce a report that was signed off by the Employment Conditions Commission on wage differentials. And on key indicator 3, reviewing existing sectoral determination, an investigation was envisaged, especially for review and to look at the whole question of a number of determinations. We managed to come up with a determination for the expanded public works program and a code of conduct for people participating or establishing EPWP scheme to guide them around how they should actually go about in terms of the conditions of employment. And a small business determination was also developed, and it was referred to NEDLEC for consideration by social partners before it could be published by the minister because of its far-reaching implications. In terms of indicator 4, civil society, 7 organizations were funded, and this include Rizela, COSATU, Sokoto, and the advice centers. And in the main, these are funded to basically assist or extend the understanding of labor market issues by those organizations that are not familiar with the regulation. On key indicator, that is the last one on impact, that is looking at the impact of the Department of Labor strategic plan, we were able to produce a report on the industrial actions, the UIF client satisfaction survey, and the compliance by the taxi industry to UIF and the domestic sector and the catering sector. In those sectors, we also conducted studies. Now, in terms of the areas that we didn't do well on our research, one of them related to the evaluation of the NSDS 2, the National Skills Development Strategy 2. Now, there was a challenge here in that this study was conducted at a time when the transfer was happening from labor to education. And in the main, what we were able to come up with was that we managed to finalize the study, and this was submitted for publication, and the recommendations thereof, that is in terms of the annual labor market review on the NSDS, the study was finalized, and there was a process to take it through with education on health and safety, that is true. The issue in the main was the question of the scope and the question of accessing various databases. On the annual review of the labor market, on the employment relations in South African creative industry, this was finalized, and integration. And on that note, Honorable Chair, it concludes the presentation. I'll ask Mr. Maduna to quickly take you through the financial aspects and the audit queries and how we spend our money during the previous financial year. That is the financial year that ended 31st March 2011.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, I will deal with Section 4 of the of our annual report on page, which starts on page 72. Although the report is structured in a way that we start with the report of the Auditor General, then our financial statements, the way the presentation has been structured is that we'll start with analyzing the budget and how we've spent it, then conclude with what Auditor General had to say about our finances. In terms of the first page on our presentation, I think I just have to take the members to our budget over the 3 year period, starting from 2008-2009, where we had an underspending of 6.15%. And in the two subsequent years, we then improved considerably, in the sense that for those 2 years, we just had the underspending of just about less than a percent. Also on that underspending of less than a percent, will also demonstrate that I think there is some reasons where we also have to have some underspending and apply for some rollovers in some particular instances. So in the year under review, which is 2010-11, we had an adjusted budget of 1.835 billion, and we have actually spent 1.826, which an underspending of 9.5 million, which amounts to 0.52%. In the next slide, we are unpacking that the original allocation of Board 17 of Labour has included in estimates of national expenditure 2010.
Okay, hold on. Please, I requested long ago your partition as a phone. They are very disturbing. You may continue, sir.
Our original allocation of Board 17 of for the Department of Labour, as included in the estimate of national expenditure for 2010, was reflected as 1.783 billion. This includes a provision in respect of transfer payments of to the value of 515 million. During 2010 adjustment budget process, the allocation for Board 17 Labour increased by 51.9 million, which is 2.9%. This included an increase to transfer payments of 28.2 million. The final allocation of Board 17, therefore, reflected in the adjusted estimates of national expenditure for 2010, came to 1.835. I think this is the movement from our original allocation of 1.783 to 1.835. And the next slide then alludes to the details of the adjustments that happened during the year, which we received a rollover of 4.4 million from the previous year. And also, we also had an unfortunate and unavoidable expense which we had to ask to beef up the budget of CCMA, and we were given 28.2 million. Over and above that, we were also given 19.3 million to beef up our allocation for the compensation of employees. So the total then, which resulted in our probable final allocation of 1.835, the 51.9 million. On the amount that was allocated to us, we managed to spend 1.826 billion, which in percentage terms was 99.5%, which then gives us an unspent amount, unspent percentage of 0.5%. The next slide talks to the allocation of our 1.8 billion into various programs in the department. Admin had an allocation of 685 million. Inspection and Enforcement Services, 329.3 million. Public Employment Services, 293 million. Labor Policy and Labor Market Programs, as it was the name then, received a allocation of 528.3 million. And we do have the expenditure for each program as put on the slide, and also the variance on the amount that was not spent by each program that was allocated to it. The next slide, well, I think it's just the same information, but in a graph format where we put each program expenditure allocation against the expenditure. The next slide then talks to the each program in particular, where we analyze the line items. I think here we wanted to highlight that the unspent amount was purely on the payment of capital assets, where we had an underspending of just 2.6 million for all in administration and IES. The spending was 100%. Public Employment Services, also there the bigger chunk of the unspent amount was on capital assets of 3.5 million. And the last program, which is LP and LMP, the underspending was on current payments. Probably just one point that we need to that I need to highlight here is that the underspend on capital payments is probably the issue that we'll encounter day in, day out when we put the government budget of cash budgeting vis-a-vis the normal operations, that we are given the money for the financial year and we are expected to spend them for that particular financial year. However, the normal operations dictate that when you order goods, some are delivered to the following week, 2 weeks or 1 month later. In some cases, we'll find that there is a year end in between, so we have to cut off. You then have to apply for a rollover for the committed funds that we have, that probably need to pay in the next financial year. Hence, the rollover that we got from the prior year of 4.4 million, and also in this particular year as well, it was the same process. Also, just to mention that the reason why we have those ones under capital goods, in some towns where we struggling to get office rental, we endeavor to build our own offices, and we engage the Department of Public Works, who should manage those programs for us. And just to mention that process is not a smooth process. The construction took normally takes longer than expected in terms of timelines to complete those particular projects, and we are caught with the closure of the year in between. Hence, we have to apply for the rollovers so that those projects can continue to go to completion. Then I think the last slide that I'm gonna conclude with is the audit outcomes for these three figures. As the acting director general has mentioned, in this year, it was the first year that the department got an unqualified audit opinion from the auditor general. However, there were just few other issues, we did not get any matter of emphasis, but additional matters that the auditor general wanted to bring to the attention of the users of the financial statements. The first issue that was highlighted was the issue of the predetermined objectives, to say that the reported indicators and targets were not consistent with the planned indicators and targets. The second issue was that the plant and reported targets were not measurable, time-bound, or well-defined. Then the other highlight that the other issue that AG highlighted was the compliance with laws and regulations with regards to the adjustment to the financial statements by management. The second point was the issue of procurement and contract management that they were unhappy with. The other one was the human resource management and compensation. Expenditure management, although in the previous years our qualification was mainly on assets, there were still some residual issues on assets that we had to deal with, where auditors deemed fit that they need to include them under other matters. There was also an issue about the investigation that was done at Indlela by DHET that was on our audit report in the year 2010-11. Those were the issues that the Auditor General highlighted with regard to our finances in the for the year 2010-11. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, but before that I'd like to thank you for this presentation and comment at the end. But nevertheless, I'll give these opportunities to the members maybe to start to ask questions or clarity. Honourable Member Groenewald.
Thank you, Chi. I've got only a couple of questions. In the first place, I want to know how many staff do you have in our first presentation in the head office? How many is working in specific in the head office? And something interesting is why are the vacancy rate higher in the professional salary band? I see it's 25%. Is there a specific reason therefore, or is it just more? If you can give us a bit more clarification around it. And then, if you are looking into our investment portfolios of 52 billion rand, that is a lot of money. Who is handling this whole portfolio? How do you manage this portfolio? And how big are the board? Who is part and parcel of it? And where are the members situated? The members on the board, are they all over South Africa? Or just on one specific area? Yes, and then the next presentation was about, I want to know if you are looking into the workplaces and you have inspections in the, how do you handle the inspections in the workplaces and what is the biggest challenges when you visit working places you have with the employer and the employee, there must be challenges. I believe there's a lot of challenges, but if you can name a couple of the challenges for us, it will be highly appreciated. And then you mentioned that you do not have the exact number, but I write the question down before you mentioned it. It is how many job seekers are in South Africa? And if you are looking into job seekers, there's many foreigners as well. Can you make a difference between South Africans and foreigners who is job seekers, and how do we help the foreigners as well in South Africa? If we are looking into what the president said, that there will be 5 million jobs. And if I'm listening to you and I'm reading the newspapers, and then I'm worried about that because sometimes there's a lot of people who is providing jobs, and on the other hand, there's a lot of people who is losing jobs. So I don't think we are nearby 5 million at this stage. And I think the cutoff date was 2016 to 2020, somewhere there. And I don't believe we are going to reach that target. If you can elaborate on that. Yeah, I've right here, we're fighting a losing battle at this stage.
I'll carry on later for a second round.
Right. Honourable Member Jacobs, Mr. President, may you please switch off your mic, please?
Yeah, thanks, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. My question on the first presentation is with regard to what is the time frame for completing a UIF claim, the average. Just want to check whether there is an improvement in the processing of UIF claims. The other one is issue of you having a 30 vacant post. It's too much when people don't have any employment. Can we get the reasons why these phones have not been filled? In your slide on page 16, I would have loved to have gender. If you say the number of employees is 259, how many are male, how many are women? I think on the issue of interns, that you have about 140, what happens after those interns have qualified? Where do they get jobs? And you said also you have 81 centers. Do we know those centers, the distribution of those centers in different provinces? You have an unemployment alleviation schemes, but if you reconciled with people who have been retrenched and those who have been allocated somewhere, I don't see an improvement. There's a vast difference. In the second presentation on the issue of companies which are in distress, are you addressing the problem or you are just putting a plaster on the cracked wall? What I would like to know, are you getting the reasons why these companies are being in distress, and how do you address those reasons? Because you cannot just say you are trying to help them without addressing the core reasons. And how do you assist them? And also, what is the process if you say this company is in distress? So what are requirements? Because I know there are many companies in the area where I come from which are in distress. So how can I assist them to say you can be helped in the Department of Labor? So what are those processes? The second one, you are saying you're investing with the PIC. Your funds. I just want to check because PIC was also investing with the ETOL. So what are the repercussions of that? As now ETOLing is standing still, so I don't think there would be any profits that we'll get. So what will be impact of the public servants who have put their monies in the PIC and the PIC investing in that company. The other one on the companies which are in distress, how do you link them up with SIDA? Because I think some of the programs, they need to be connected with SIDA as I know them. The other one, I just wanted to know the breakdown on office accommodations from the treasurer, the CEO, the CFO. He said they are building their own offices. How many have been completed, and in which areas? In which areas are you building these offices? Thank you.
Right. I'd just like to add one of maybe to request you about the issue of vacancies. In one of the presentations, you spoke about the vacancies, on what Honorable Groenewald also alluded to. But my worry is, one, if the vacant posts are big, as you indicated, I won't go to the vacant rate. I wanted the clarity to know that, are they paid vacancies, or what is the status quo? So that you can see that, the cause of that, why we leave this, because in terms of the law, you're supposed to have filled most of the vacancies. Because where it rises a challenge, it links with the issue of capacity. Sometimes the capacity, another contribution factor of the capacity, is that some of the posts, they are vacant. And then also, that also lead for this money which you spoke about, or come with that percentage of 4 something, the rollovers. Rollover can be positive, it can be negative most of the time. So may you please clarify us on that one. And also what is worrying me is the issue of, you had a target of the youth, which is 50%, and as the time goes on, you realize that it's not maybe conducive to reach that target of 50%. My question is that, when did the department realize that this was unrealistic target of the issue of youth? Then also, there is a thing which is worrying me. Somewhere it is reported that if you go to Limpopo and also you go to Free State, no companies has applied for foreign labor. While these provinces are sharing borders with some of these countries. And my problem, which is worrying me, is that, and we know that there are a number of people who are employed in South Africa from those particular areas. And my question will be, what could be the reasons for this, that these companies are not registered, and that didn't apply for foreign labor? And then also, somewhere which I've noted this this report. You see, but the comments of the Auditor General, you know, maybe you should have received a clean audit, but because of the reasons and which were indicated by the Auditor General for worrying us, I'll put an example. A few days ago, we visited Limpopo in terms of the follow-up, in terms of the intervention there. These reasons which were put by the Auditor General, these are the gist of the matter which is causing problems. That indicators and targets not consistent with planned indicators and targets. It's worrying. And then also, that the planned and reported target not measurable. It's not measurable. I wonder whether, who trusted? You see, sometimes when plans are not measurable, it's because sometimes, not always, there is no interaction among the department, among the centers. Somebody or a certain block has just dropped it without consulting the other center. That's why it's not measurable. It means that your system doesn't talk to each other. That's why most of the time we talk about the risk management, whether do we have a risk management in that regard. Because the purpose of the risk management is to alarm that, hey, there will be danger coming. And then also, which is the most embarrassment, which is worrying me, the compliance with the laws and regulations as accounting for officers who are supposed to stick as a measuring rule or measuring rod or ruler. That for example, the issue of procurement and contract management is worrying me. Very, very worrying me. The issue of management. Management go back to the capacity. And when you talk about human resource management and compensation and also expenditure management, asset, you know, what will bring this government down is the issue of assets. In all levels, whatever department, the issue of assets, you see, it's now 18 years we're in power, but some departments are failing to tell us exactly about the assets of the government. While each and every year we make some proposals that we adjust your budgets. I can go on and on and on, but I wanted maybe to leave there. But before I leave there, the issue of transfer of skills, I think, came also in the report of the Auditor General. And another thing, what I wanted to get from you, the last one, you see, Acting GG, we ought to be very careful about the issue of outsourcing. And I wanted to know that how much was paid for the consultants in order to perform the internal audit functions. That's why it's a problem. Why do we do duplication while we do have women and men within the department who can do correct work? So if you can, that's from the audit committee. If you can maybe highlight for us then. I said I'll comment last. I'll comment with something when we finish about this. Not now. I'll allow you to ask questions. Sorry. On this one.
Chair, it is linked to what you are saying on the issue of Auditor General's comments. I just want to know the CF, does we have an action plan to address all the issues that have been raised by the Auditor General? And where is that plan?
Okay, I will allow you because I've done it to Babichiko, but not so long.
No. Very speaking. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know, maybe I misunderstand it. On page slide 44, you said you funded unions, COSATU, and why? I want to know, maybe just give me clarity about it. I'm under that impression that there's a lot of names there. COSATU is one of them, and they are funded by you. Doesn't make sense for me, but if you can just give me. And then the last thing is, if you are regarding to build your own assets and buildings, keep away from public works, please.
Okay, let's do this. The last one, if you maybe clarify in your package, the criteria used to pay advance offices. Because, for example, myself, I've got a little experience with advice. I was trained by Sheena Duncan and some of the people, most of the advice offices shut down because there were no supplements or incentives. So that we can assist you to mobilize people to continue to advise offices. Over to you.
No, thanks a lot, honorable members and honorable chairperson. I will request that Ms. Puzi and the team deal with the UIF questions first. And I will deal with a number of other departmental questions. There's one or two that Ms. Lerato Mlebatsi will address on the vacancy, and the CFO will then deal with the financial related ones. Maybe if you can start, and then I'll take the last one. I noted all the questions, and as they present, I will make sure that I tick. If there are others remaining, I'll go back to them.
Thank you, honorable members, for the questions. I will respond specifically to the UIF questions. There was the questions from the Honourable Member Groenewald. The first question was on the staff complement at head office. If you look at, I think there's a slide where we're talking about the head office structure, we have about 455 staff members at head office. That are solely responsible for UIF functions. In the provinces and labor centers, we are using what we call a shared services with the Department of Labor and Compensation Fund, where we pay a percentage split. For instance, I'll make an example of your reception or your front line, where we use one resource for both the Department of Labor functions, UIF, and compensation. There we pay a third in terms of the salaries for all the costs, including the rental of the space and everything that they use in the provinces. But for head office, the staff complement is 455. And then there was also another question around the issue of our reserves, rather our investments, the 52 billion. The question was, who is sitting there? What are the governing structures around the issues of investment? We have a board of directors, which constitutes of members from labor, from community, and business. In terms of how we arrive at our investment mandate or strategy, we have actuaries who would then do their evaluations in terms of what are the liabilities for the UIF, and they would then propose in terms of how you could then invest those funding. And then in terms of our structures or our processes, it would then, the report from the actuaries would go to what we call an investment committee, which comprises of business, labor, and community, to look at the recommendations from the actuaries. Then they would use that discretion in terms of how they would also want to see the investment of those funds. Then there's also a board, which then looks at the recommendation of the investment committee. We then invest with PIC as dictated by the PFMA, since the UIF falls under as a public entity. And then there was also a question about intent, to say, of the 104, I think it was a question from Honourable Jacobs, to say, of the 104 interns that we have, what happens to them after the expiry of their term? Essentially, we would like to absorb them, but we don't have structures to absorb all of them. We give them work experience, and in cases where there is a post, we prioritize them and would then absorb them in the vacant position. Otherwise, if there's no position, we give them that work experience and then we assist them to get jobs. There was also another question in terms of the vacancies, the number of vacancies. In fact, there are two questions around the staff complement. One would be the member would have loved to see the gender. We don't have that report now. However, we can avail it to the members. And then in terms of the numbers, if you look at the big vacancy rate, it's at your lower levels. I think there's a lot of mobility because, you know, it's so easy for them to find jobs elsewhere. And some of them are even getting promotions within the organization. So it's just a matter of timing, because as soon as the position is vacant, we start advertising. So you would now and then have a vacant position because some of them, they are being moved from one position to maybe from SR level 5 to SR level 7. So you'd always see that mobility and vacancies. But what we strive to do is to advertise and fill those posts immediately. And there was also a question around the structures to say, are these funded posts? Yes, these are funded vacant posts. So there is no issue of saying we can't fill them. We advertise as soon as the position is vacant. However, what normally sometimes takes time in terms of the recruitment is your near verification, because we also have to take them to for security clearance before the post is filled. So that results in delays in filling those posts.
Sorry, Jim, just a follow-up on this, because I want to know the professional salary band. There's a 25% of the vacancy.
Okay, okay.
And what is the reason?
Okay, hold on. In future, you raise your hand and you press the mic so that the thing is recorded. You can repeat it.
Sorry, G. No, I just want to know the professional salary band. There's a 25% vacancy, and what I want to know, why is it so high in the professional side?
Okay, over to you. You can continue.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. If you look at the SMS level, I think it's level... we were sitting at 25%. The numbers of the posts there are around, there are 12. Filled, it's 9. And then if you look at the 3 and then you weight, it gives you a bigger percentage because the numbers are less. Now, this level, at your SMS level, that's where you find that there's, I think the 3 posts, it was one of it is the acting CFO, of which has taken a longer time to fill. But the process has started in terms of advertising the post. I think it's 3 posts that are vacant. So if you average them or you percentage them, the percentage rate is very high. This is the area where, especially from level 14, where the minister is involved in terms of the appointment. The delegations with the commissioner are from level 13 and below. But the process has already started in ensuring that these 4 bare posts are filled. Then there was also another question around the time frames. How long does it take to process and finalize the UIF claim? In terms of our standard, we are saying we need to process the claim within 5 days of receipt of all the documentation. Now, the challenge that we normally face is your incomplete documentation, because there's where an employer has to submit the declaration to say, yes, this employee was working for me from this time to this time, and this person was in and so much. But in that area, we often face challenges because the employers sometimes don't submit on the due time or the due dates, you know, to ensure that we process timelessly. In that case, we work very closely with the department in terms of sending the inspector to that employer to ensure that the UI-19 is submitted to us so that we can process the claim. But if everything is submitted by the beneficiary, the claim is finalized within 5 weeks. 5 weeks of 5 weeks. It's 5 weeks. No, it's 5 weeks.
Don't worry, man, we are protected. Continue.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. And then there was another question about the and labor centers where the honorable member wanted to know where are these 81 labor centers. If you look at slide number 7 of our presentation, I think this is the slide, you would see there where we are talking about the 9 provinces. We're also talking about the labor centers. You can see that when we talk about Gauteng, our processing offices is Benoni, Bronkhorst Spruit, Carletonville, Harankua. Then you go through the list, then you will see what we're talking about when we're talking about the processing centers. They're listed. And then finally, Chair, from our side, there was also a question about the alleviation schemes to say we have not done much, looking at the money that has been set aside. Yes, we agree. The process, I think, since this is a new intervention, it took very long to, you know, to move at the pace that we wanted. And there are so many controls that have been put in place to ensure that we give assistance to the deserving companies. But I think in future, you will see the growth in terms of our interventions. But because this was quite very new interventions, there's nothing much that has been done considering the money that we have set aside from our side to assist in terms of these schemes. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, Ms. Mulebatsi will deal with the administration questions. And that is corporate services, occupational health and safety, Mr. Lamati, and we have questions around the performance indicator, which was Dudu will deal with, and there was also a question on the funding of civil society, which the labor relations colleagues will deal with, and then finance, Mr. Matu. I'll deal with the employment services later.
Thank you, Chair. I will deal with the questions in no particular order, but I'll start with the question around public works. We actually have no choice in the matter. Public works are the people that whose services we procure in terms of getting accommodation. It is not always the most ideal situation to deal with. There are challenges, but internally we are also looking at how best to manage the relationship between ourselves and public works in order to maximize on the investment that we make in the buildings that house our offices. And then there was a question around youth employment. Our target for youth employment is 50%, and of course, we bearing in mind that this is financial year 2010-11, and things have moved since then. From a target of 50%, we managed to get a 42.84%, which is lower by about 7% in a bit. Now, the challenges around youth employment is that, of course, we do have an older workforce, and in a lot of the instances, for us to be able to attract new employees, we have to allow natural attrition, people retiring, people dying within the organization, and so on, in order to replace them with younger people. And also we do sit with the challenge of ensuring that we also employ people living with people with disabilities, and also the balance in terms of gender. So those are some of the complexities around the numbers that we've been able to attract in terms of the youth, why it has not moved as quickly as we'd have liked it to move. But I would also like to add that in terms of the vacancy rates, the vacancy rate that you see there is 8.59%. We have moved sitting at about 7%, and in fact, we are one of the departments with some of the lowest vacancy rates. But we are not relaxing. We are aggressively trying to push and ensure that we do fill in these vacancies, because we realize the importance of leading in filling these job vacancies. Some of the challenges there again are that we need to also verify qualifications through SACA. That process takes long. We need to get people accredited through NIA, and they must also be vetted. And of course, this revolving door syndrome. You get one in, one goes out because they've gotten a better position at another government department or in the private sector, or that people are retiring and so on and so forth. But we are working very hard to ensure that these levels are the level of vacancies are as low as possible, to a point where we are trying to work on a zero vacancy rate, which is not always possible, but we're working towards that. There was a question around the use of consultants, and I think, Chairperson, that question came from you. At the Department of Labor, we have an internal audit capability, so we're not using consultants for internal auditing purposes, because we do have that capability, and there's the sufficient capacity internally. So it would not apply. The other question is a question around the transfer of skills by Siemens in the Triple P. Chairperson and honourable members, you might be aware that the Triple P contract is coming to an end at the end of November, this year. And in terms of skills, it has been a very trying process, and I think we have spoken to the Select Committee, and we've also spoken to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee regarding this matter. When the Triple P contract was put together, one of the conditions of the Triple P was that employees were taken from out of the department and became part of Siemens in order to give us this particular service. So going forward, we've recognized that this was one of the most deficiencies in terms of the way in which the contract was structured, because Treasury put this together with on behalf of both parties. So going forward, we realize that this is a big issue, and we are working now towards basically growing our own timber, getting people internally who we are going to employ, who are going to be part of the department in fulfilling the ICT mandate of the department. I think I have covered everything, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay, before we proceed, I wanted to comment something. I think my question was very relevant, still outstanding in terms of the consultants. I was referring to the AG's remark for the UIF, not for the department who are using the consultants. You can continue the next one. I think my question is still relevant. Why using consultants?
Thank you, Honorable Chair and the Honorable Members. There were two questions that were related to inspections at workplaces. One says, how do you handle inspections at workplaces? We have planned visits that we do to workplaces, and sometimes we just rock up there because the legislation allows us to go to workplaces unannounced. And depending on the size of the entity, we would send one inspector if it's a small entity. But if it's a bigger entity, we'll then send a team of inspectors who, that team will have different expertise in terms of the areas of focus. We'll have a team, you'll have an inspector which focuses on employment equity, and you'll have an inspector which focuses on occupational health and safety. You have an inspector, depending on the sector, again, which will look at issues relating to that specific sector. If it's a hospitality sector, that inspector will look at the issues relating to the sectoral determination for the hospitality industry. And then you will have a team during an inspection that will look at the documents, the wage register, risk assessment, and you will have a team that will then do what we refer to as a walkthrough, which is a physical inspection, looking at the factory itself, or just to check if it complies with the provisions of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, and that's the process that we follow. And of course, depending on the nature of the transgressions that the inspectors would have picked up, we then issue a notice to the employer which says we have not complied with X, Y, and Z, and you are given a specific time. If it's an occupational health and safety transgression, we'll give the employer 60 days to comply. Or if it's a life-threatening matter, we'll issue the employer with a prohibition notice immediately, which says you shall not continue with what you are doing up until you have addressed the following issues. And if it's a labor-related or basic condition of employment matter, we'll then issue ensure that the employer makes an undertaking to address the problem, because the law says we must endeavor to make sure that the employer makes an undertaking. And if the employer does not want to make an undertaking, we then issue the employer with a compliance order, which orders him or her to comply with the law. And all these processes, if they are not complied with, they lead to us taking the matter to either labor court or to the criminal court. The second question relates to the challenges that we encounter as well as inspectors at workplaces. I think the biggest challenge that we encounter is the high levels of ignorance with regards to the legislative responsibilities that employers have. And the second one is the over reliance on labor consultants, especially in the farming environment, where you'll rock up and the employer will say, or the farmer will say, I don't know anything about what you're talking about, just wait a little bit, I'll phone my labor consultant. And that to us presents us with a huge problem, because most of the time it seems to us that the labor consultants are advising the employers as to how not to comply with the law. And that's the biggest challenge that we're picking up. And again, I think the other challenge that we're picking up, especially in the hospitality sector, is the increase in the number of foreign employees, which, if you look at the minimum wage in the hospitality industry, they are earning far below that, and I think they've accepted the situation because they are foreigners, and therefore they are prepared to earn less than what the minimum wage prescribes. So I think that's one of the key issues that we pick up. And obviously, the penalties that are prescribed in the legislation, especially in the Occupational Health and Safety Act, are not serving as a deterrent. And that's why the department has taken a decision to effect amendments to a number of legislations, including the Occupational Health and Safety Act, just to make sure that the penalties do serve the purposes that they were intended for. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I'll check the questions on performance information. Yes, there were challenges in terms of performance information.
Sorry, ma'am, may you please raise your mic? I'm begging you, because it was so sorry.
Okay, but
you poor pull it still. Okay.
I think it will be fine now. Thanks, Chair. I was saying there were challenges, and yes, there is an action plan on all Auditor General findings. The department does not plan in silos. We follow a specific strategic planning process where branches together with provincial representatives, sit together and draft their plans for the three-year cycle. These draft strategic plans then follow a certain process. They get presented to the weekly management meeting that is chaired by the accounting officer, the DG, and then it gets presented to the departmental executive committee, which is also chaired by the DG, but then has other stakeholders like all the funds and the provincial representatives sitting there. After that, that draft plan goes then for approval, where the accounting officer approves it, and then eventually the minister approves it. And in terms of reporting, we report quarterly in that departmental executive committee meeting, and at the midterm, there is a midterm review that we hold maybe over 2 or 2.5 days, which is chaired by the minister. And after that, we then go for our third and last quarter, where we then produce an annual report. What has subsequently happened after these findings? We've arranged training with National Treasury to come and retrain and reskill our planners and our compilers of quarterly and annual reports. It's National Treasury, the Technical Assistance Unit, and the DPSA Palama to come and train us on risk-based reporting. Throughout this process of planning and reporting, we do involve risk management and internal audit to have a look at the reports and verify them. I've also designed a reporting template which IT has locked as from now 2012-13 financially. IT has locked it so that we avoid the issue of indicators that have been approved in the strat plan being tampered with or changed during the year. So this problem I think will be resolved, because remember, this is a report from 2010-11, so there have been some actions that we have taken in the department. Another thing that I would like just to mention is that when this planning happens, we look at the mandate, we look at past performance, we look at the budget, we look at capacity, and then the risks. And then we come up with the plans. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I will deal with two questions in relation to the civil society strengthened, or civil society fund, and also a specific question from the Honorable Frole Walt in relation to COSATU funding. I think what I would like to indicate is that, firstly, when we look at the funding of different institutions, we actually look at it against the performance, you know, target. That we're looking at institutions, organizations which will empower vulnerable workers. And if you actually look at where these institutions, most of them are, where the funding was actually allocated, is the rural areas wherein there's no labor center or there's no access to labor centers or to the information. So there is a committee which is set up by the department looking at the proposals. So each and every organization which needs funding will then submit its proposal to the committee, and the committee will look at it against, you know, the indicators I've indicated, protection of vulnerable workers. And in this case, in relation to COSATU, is more on the training of the shop steward rather than any other thing. Those who will, you know, especially in the farming sector, as Mr. Lamati has indicated, that
some instances there are challenges in relation to the farm workers who are located in the area, so they cannot have or access information in terms of their rights. So the allocation of funds actually will be looking at those issues as compared to an organization. And then after receiving the proposal, then the committee will decide in terms of who needs to be funded or will be funded. And then there will also be some visits which will be conducted to an organization to monitor and the reports, you know, monitoring the performance of that organization. Thank you, Chair.
Then, Chair, I think I will deal with the office accommodation, the breakdown, and also how many have been completed. The second point is the rollovers. The third one, compliance to laws and regulations. The fourth one being the AG action plan. The comment about the building of offices, stay away from public works. I will deal with it when I'm dealing with maybe number one. Chair, I think the challenge that we have is that mainly just say that I will probably, I don't have the breakdown of the offices that are being built, or the list of all of offices that we have that are being built by Public Works. I will make that one that at least available. I think the one that is probably just being completed that is in the top of my mind is the Rustenburg office, simply because there has been a lot of activities in terms of claims by Public Works to pay the constructor on site. But I was there last time, and yes, the building is progressing very well. But just to say that I think there are quite a number of steps that are involved, that in terms of us getting some permanent offices where we are struggling with rental. And it starts with the site identification, and also Public Work securing the site so that they can start building. In most cases, we find that the land belongs to a municipality, so they normally struggle towards, I think, the process to get that land into their books for them to start building, so that they build the building in the land that they own. It's normally also taking some time. Also, in the process, they have to engage the engineers for site clearance, and then they then perform the project management on the contractors that they have appointed. These are the processes that they have engaged in. Well, I think there is a lot that need to be improved on their side in these particular instances, because we've got quite a list of towns where we've requested them to get us permanent offices because of the challenges with buildings in those towns. This is an area engagement that we are engaging them with in terms of maybe speeding this process. But the whole list in terms of which towns and how far is the process, I will make that available to the committee. In terms of the rollovers, yes, Chair, I think I have gone to town in terms of explaining the rollovers and the presentation. But just to demonstrate the point, I think in the presentation that I've made, in the slide where we had an adjustment during the financial year of 51.9, for 2009-10, we were approved a rollover of 4.4 million, precisely because of the accruals or commitments that were made in that particular year. Simple, because we are given cash to spend in that particular year. But the challenge is, on the normal business process, things are not going to be paid instantly. There will be instances where we have to maybe pay 3 weeks or some time later, and you have to make a cut-off. So the accruals that were granted to us were as a result of that the Treasury recognizes that if the rollover is not granted, then our next financial year's budget are going to be affected, because we'll start by paying off the expenditure of the previous year. So that is why we normally have that's why the rollover is there, to make sure that the budget for that particular year covers the performance that we're going to provide, that we said we're going to do for that particular year. And the rollover from the previous year is normally granted, so that we normally separate the two. In terms of compliance to laws and regulation, I think as a department we are coming a long way. We had a qualification the previous year, so we're dealing with those things. There were really residual areas in terms of procurement, expenditure, and assets that we are dealing with. And also we're acknowledging that in financial management, every year we start on a clean slate with the clean money. Therefore, we need to beef up those controls. But this is a constant struggle that we are engaging in terms of training and training and training, and also probably taking also the results of the AG to highlight where the possible challenges are and sticking on those ones to make sure that we improve on the subsequent year. In terms of the AG action plan, yes, we did an action plan. I think if you go to page 89 of our report, AG extracted the action plan for the year 2009-10, which was dealing with qualification. It was included in the report. I think in the subsequent year, which is going to be 11-12, I think the same thing is going to be done. A sample of the an action plan is going to be instructed and put into our annual report. So every year we do develop an action plan, and when the Auditor General audits, they also look into it. And now there is a process of getting them some extracts of that action plan and putting it in our report. I think that concludes the issues from my side. That relates to finance. That's.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. There were quite a number of other questions that were raised by Honourable Groenewald. The first one deals with the total number of job seekers in South Africa. Now, Honourable Groenewald, this is a very difficult question. Estimate currently says the unemployment rate stands at 25%. Youth unemployment is about 3.7 million. Now, from the Department of Labour side, there are two instruments that we are using at the moment. The Unemployment Insurance Fund gives you an indication in terms of the total number of people employed and registered with SARS. But then its shortcomings is that it does not include public servants, and it does not also include a lot of people who are not registered. Now, there are a lot of taxi drivers. If you go down out of Parliament, there are a lot of people selling flowers, etc. We still have a problem in the country in terms of an actual definition of who is employed and who is unemployed, because some of the people may be doing odd jobs and earning enough money, but because of tax reasons, they don't want to declare it, and therefore they are regarded as unemployed. So, and I think the other thing that we are doing through the registration is to make sure that we have people in local communities, and we are working with StatsSA on the registration of job seekers in the Department of Labor database, so that in every community and municipality, we can know exactly who are unemployed, where do they stay, and for how long they are unemployed. In the bill that is coming on employment services, there's a provision also to deregister them, so that if a person does not come back, for instance, after 2 months or 3 months, you automatically remove them from the database, because you will assume that the person is employed, and the onus will be for that person to come back and say, yes, I'm not employed or not, because you take countries like India with more than 1.3 billion and they say the unemployment is 15%, and yet the informal economy is about 90%. So there's something that is being done there around checking who is employed, who is unemployed, and so on. Now, whether we can distinguish between a South African and a foreign national. Now, again, this is a very difficult one, because in terms of just looking at a person, I don't think it's possible. But in terms of statistics, you can only distinguish using documented foreign nationals. Where people are illegal in the country, it's very difficult to distinguish those. And I think the reason why we're working with Home Affairs also as part of our immigration management is to try and make sure that we have the country, including asylum seekers, there is still a big challenge on undocumented foreign nationals, because those are you don't know how many there are and where they are. I think Mr. Lamati did pick up an issue around the number of people we find in farms that take these jobs and they can't be registered because they are not documented, and as a result they are exploited. But our laws, all labor laws, protect all workers that are in the country, citizens and foreign nationals. As long as they are employed, they are supposed to be paid the wages that have been agreed. Whether an employer pays a different salary is a different issue. That is why when we find them, we call Home Affairs to arrest them for employing an undocumented migrant worker. The 5 million jobs, whether they can be, the target can be achieved. Now, I think the president, it's a national question, and I'm sure the president has responded to this question in Parliament regarding whether we can or we cannot. And I think he has stated reasons why there's a challenge on the 5 million. Honorable Jacobs, there were questions around distressed companies. Are we addressing the problem and the causes? The distressed companies are clearly defined in terms of the global agreement that was signed at NEDLAC and was negotiated extensively between government, labor, and business, so that we are very clear in terms of who is distressed and who is not. Secondly, the reason that may explain the low uptake and why other companies ran away from applying is that they are required in terms of the procedure that we follow. There's a chart that is very clear in terms of what is it. Firstly, the company and the trade union must agree that the company is in distress, and it's very easy, because if a company in the salary negotiation said they are broke, and when they reported to their shareholders and they said they made profit, then they can't come to us and say they are in distress. So when the first step is to go to the CCMA with the unions and their books to prove what was their investment, what was their income, trading, in which way were they affected, and so on. And I did say that we have since adjusted the rules to include companies that are involved in disaster like Darwin and so on. There were floods, and those companies could not be assisted because the criteria we had excluded them. So the criteria is very extensive. The CCMA is the first point of call. Once the CCMA has signed an agreement between employers and trade unions, the second step will be the CETA to look at their financial side on the training component, and the third one will be a committee in the department that consists of the Department of Labor, Economic Development, Department of Higher Education and Training, and in the Department of Labor is both the UIF and the Employment Services, who then considers the application. And even then, we don't pay them all the amount. Only workers that qualify to earn the rate as determined by the basic conditions of employment are entitled to 50% of their income, because the 50%, other 50% is paid by the employer, and we don't pay that other half. So we can make those jobs available so that you can look at them. There was a further question on whether we link them with CEDA. In the main, CEDA is the people that we link are SMMEs. This will be big companies that would normally be beyond what CEDA fund. And the intervention is not funding the companies. I did indicate in the presentation that the UIF has given 48.5 million productivity in South Africa. And the reason why they gave that amount of money is that if a company says, before they can say they're in distress, the first step is to say we are losing business and to quickly go to productivity South Africa so that they can assist them in their turnaround strategies, basically identification of wastage processes that are not productive and their niche market, and to turn around the company. And only as the last result is then that they come forward for the investment. Honorable Groenewald, the question on the investment with PIC and the possible repercussion for the public servants, pension funds, UIF and CF, etc. Now, I think firstly, there's a prescription that these funds must be invested with PIC. And there's a law, which is the Public Finance Management Act, that we must observe. But I think at a broader level, all those funds are given as a loan. And what we know is that they must be paid. I wouldn't go into the tolling because that's a court case, and it's also, I'm sure there are appropriate people who can answer better some of the complications and the intricacies. Honorable Sibande, Chairperson, your question was twofold. I understood that the one part talks to the number of companies that have not applied in Limpopo and Free State on the training layoff scheme, and I did say that the question of them not applying is due to the fact that either they were running away from those things that the criteria, opening up books and all that. But you also mentioned in the process the question of foreign labor, which is a slightly different matter. The foreign labor part has to do with our work around migration management, and this has to do with the work permit process. Normally, companies would say, we have this kind of work and we don't have local people. They will have, under the Immigration Act, to follow a process that says apply to bring so many people, be it from Zimbabwe, Lesotho, Korea, or from wherever. And that is where they apply for corporate permit or work permit to bring in migrant workers. Now, we do have a process that we are working with Home Affairs and Foreign Affairs around the management of this process. It's a very complex process. And the reason why we're having a database and trying to document skilled workers is to be able to say we may not have a skilled worker in Limpopo that you need, but from the database, we know that we have a person with the skill that you need in KZN. And what we want is to promote local migration by South Africa to move from one part of the province to work in another part of their own country, rather than to say simply because we don't have a person with skill that is needed by a particular company in Limpopo or Mpumalanga, will therefore give a work permit to a foreign national to come and work in Limpopo. So I think I may have understood you, but there were those two parts to the question. And I think the other question, I will request the unemployment insurance fund colleagues to go back to that question on consultant that was not dealt with. But from the list, I was ticking all the questions, and if we skipped any by oversight, we will attempt to deal with that, Honorable Chairperson.
Okay. Is there any addition?
Yes, Chairperson, you had a question.
fact, it's not from Auditor General funds, it's from Audit Committee.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yes, Chairperson, the UIF has an internal audit function. However, in terms of the numbers or the capacity, it is it's not supporting the functions that needed to be done. So what had to be done at the time was to co-source the services of the internal auditors to assist the internal audit to finalize its audit plan for the year. However, what we've done to date was to look at the appropriate structure that would make the internal audit function optimally. We have a new proposed structure that has been approved by the Minister of Labour. It is now sitting with the Minister of Public Works for us to be able to capacitate that unit. So as soon as that new proposed structure has been approved, we'll fill those posts and there will be no need to use the consultants. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. Ntana Sivalini, colleagues, if you can check time is behind us. That is a request from me, from my colleagues. But if you want to continue, if you want us to continue, you can continue.
Two issues.
Yeah. Okay. The first one is also to check on companies which are not complying. Has it ever happened that they have been taken to courts, and how many of them, and what were the outcomes of all that? The second one on companies on distress. In fact, I was not referring to big business, because companies which are struggling, there are those of SMEs. But if that is the case, it means we are not addressing the problem, because most of the companies which are struggling are the SMEs. So your response, your focus is on big business, and you are not accommodating the SMEs.
So may you please open, there is a slide which you open on page 35, training layoff schemes, application per province. I wanted to comment with that one. Maybe if you can clarify us, yes, this one correctly, so what criteria do you use in terms of this application of companies? I mean, about the funds, somehow the weather. Let's say the money is from the labor, or is the money which they are contributing. But if the money is the money which they are contributing, I'll be satisfied. But if this money is being contributed by labor to them, I'll have a problem. I'll put an example. If you check Eastern Cape, number of workers are 436, and then the amount is 3 million. Then you go to KZN, it's 1,133. The money is nearly the same, it's 2.9. And then also you go to, I mean, that different. I'm not clear what is happening, if you can clarify us. You go to, which is the other one, it's Western Cape, which is 1,900, and then the amount is 5.8. So why is not equal? What criteria is being used? That's all.
Okay. Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Firstly, I did the source of the money is from a commitment that was made by the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the National Skills Fund, and announced by the President during the not this current year, but the previous financial year's state of, that is the 2009 State of the Nation address, where the President announced a training layoff scheme to be implemented at a tune of 2.4 billion rand.
money that is going to the employers. To try and give a simple explanation is that if there are two people, myself and Paul, and I earn above the threshold set by the basic conditions, I'm excluded. Tola earns below the threshold set by the basic conditions of employment. He will then be considered. And the reason why that is the case is that people earning above the threshold set by the basic conditions of employment do not contribute to the unemployment insurance fund. Everybody contributes 1% of their payroll, and the employer contributes the other 1% of their payroll. So depending on the number of workers affected and the agreement reached, and the company decide to say, instead of retrenching these workers, we will go on short time. Short time simply means that instead of working the full 5 days, they will work for 2 days, and the 3 days workers ordinarily will be at home. Now, instead of those workers sitting at home, now it's not compulsory. Workers can choose if they want to remain at home, I mean work for 2 days, and they want to remain at home for the other 3 days. They will be paid a salary for 2 days, and for 3 days they will get nothing. But any employee who chooses to participate in the training layoff scheme, that is, for the 3 days that they ordinarily should have been at home, but they decide to take their books and to go for a training program in a training center, then they are eligible for the training scheme. And what the money is normally used towards is to pay them 50% of their wages. If the worker earns, let's say, 1,000 rand, the UIF and NSF will give you 500 rand for turning up to attend training, because the whole idea is to encourage people to learn during the short time so that they can capacitate their own skills. And the employer is also compelled, for every employee who attends a training scheme, to pay the other 50%. And that is towards the medical aid, the pension fund contribution, UIF contribution, and so on, so that the worker is not well off. But if the worker chooses to stay at home, the employer has also the right to withdraw the other component. That is what the training of scheme. The amount has nothing to do with the province per se, but it has to do with the sector. If it could be that, for instance, in the Western Cape or in Mpumalanga, the workers involved could have been in a sector that has been low paying, or the numbers involved were earning lower salaries, and the company applied for the scheme, and the allocations were in line with that. So normally we can give you a breakdown of the information, but it has nothing to do with the choice of the province. It has to do with the income of an employee, and the money goes directly as a replacement income to a worker and not an employee. And maybe the second question, Honorable Jacobs, whether the scheme is targeted at SMMEs. Now, this is one of the challenges that we had faced, because a lot of small companies, you'll find that they are not contributing unemployment insurance fund or skills levy, and that on its own automatically disqualified them, because you had to use the employee has to be registered with the UI in order to benefit, and the employer must have been paying skills levy against that employee in order for them to be eligible for the National Skills Fund. So the only way that we are assisting SMMEs is through our social plan, which is partly the training of SMME managers with respect to the intellectual property management and all that. We did have a very strong program that we used to run under the Department of Labor under the National Skills Fund. However, with the transfer of skills development funding and the NSF from Department of Labor to Department of Education, we no longer have roles or resources to do that. And that is why that program is now with the Department of Education. I thought that those were the questions that were raised. Unless if I omitted it. Thank you. And there was one on the inspection side.
Thank you, Chair. Slide 20 of the presentation that was done by the acting DG does reflect the number of cases that were referred to both the Labour Court and the Magistrate Courts. And in some instances, we have reflected the outcome of the of such referrals. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Right, can I comment something and then we close the meeting? You see, with the question which I was asking in terms of the very same page which I was asking, the applications are only 19, but no, don't respond now for a package. The another key fundamental challenge is that what is the department doing in order to encourage people to apply, to have more applications, rather than to have only 19 applications, while there are a lot of factories and like, or companies. And also, you see, you were correct that we accept that the issue of e-tolling is sub judice. We can't debate it. As well as that issue which you raised about how to determine that a person is a foreign, whether it's our suits which are the same, because we're too dark. In the past, that thing was happening, very darkest skin, we referred as a foreign. I think we're satisfied because I think continuously people must be educated in those regards. Because our country is having a policy and whatever. And that's correct. And then what is my worry? Acting DG, with this presentation which you presented, please, we're not comfortable with some of the things which you're normally doing. This one then, from your side. First page, is written correctly so that presentation to the select committee and the date 22. But if you go somewhere inside, you know, these are records and people they got this thing. We're not interested with this thing of cut and paste. No, it mustn't happen like that. On page 35, you can open page 35 and check what is written there. You see, I was happy that at least the content was so careful, were very sensitive or some of the things. No, not specific. At least, I mean, the first presentation. For us, we're very sensitive about the issue of cut and paste. We can pick that thing up as soon as possible. Because it's somewhere in page 35, open page 35 on this one, and read it for yourself, you can see that this thing was not for us. Yes. Reavua, Enkosi, thank you, Danki, Minister. Portfolio Committee of Labour. We're not the Portfolio Committee. Mm-hmm. And people are keeping records on this regard. We are the Select Committee, not the Portfolio Committee. To some people, they can see, look as if it is a small onion, I think to us it means a lot. It means a lot. And that tells you that the person who sent us this information, they didn't go through, they just cut and paste and send it to us. To us who are very sensitive because we read. Whatever you give to us, we concentrate, we read. So how do you justify this thing? In other ways, it's two ways. Like myself, I'm a man this side, I'm a woman this side. It mustn't happen again. It must never happen again. And then to members and also to you, procedurally we're supposed to adopt these reports. But what I would suggest is 2 shelves. And then there's no need also to call the department. It will form part of the package from our side, including the minutes which were supposed to be adopted. Let us put them aside because we don't form a quorum. And in the meetings, then adjourn. I thank you.